In Mary Oliver's poem, On Losing a House, the poet sums up the bewilderment that she and her partner felt at having to pack up and leave their home of many years. Where will we go with our table and chairs, our bed, our 9,000 books, our TV, PC, VCR, our cat who is 16 years old? Where will we put down our dishes and our blue carpets? Where will we put up our rose-colored rice paper shades? Their modest house was near the water on Cape Cod, and it was sold out from under them to wealthy investors. She writes, "Oh, what is money? Oh, never in our lives have we thought about money. Oh, we have only a little money. Oh, now in our sleep we dream of finding money. But someone else already has money. Money, money, money. Someone else can sign the papers, can turn the key. Oh, dark, oh, heavy, oh, mossy money." How much money is enough? This important question is not one to be shamed out of thinking about in your life. Thousands of years ago, human beings invented money as a tool. Think of money as a common language for trading goods, labor, skill, time, and property. It can provide the means to security, comfort, freedom, and influence among people. With money, we can express appreciation, we can obtain enjoyable experiences, we can buy food. But money also can be the source of insecurity. In our society, so much revolves around the tool of money that many of us are vexed by obsession about how much is enough. This can bring stress, distraction, self-doubt, and worry for ourselves and those we care about. Concerns about our relationship to money can bring spiritual suffering. Not having enough money for our basic needs can be agonizing. For example, some families must choose between paying the rent and buying all the groceries they need. Some people put off attending to health care due to the cost. Since 2008, the collapse of the financial house of cards, known as mortgage banking, and the bursting of the real estate bubble have knocked thousands of people out of their homes, leaving them with broken dreams, lost investments, ruined credit, and a sense of dislocation. Where will we go with our table and chairs, our bed? The recent economic downturn put California in a terrible budget crisis. State budget cuts have hurt our public school systems, students in our public universities and our community colleges, and many social services like adult day health care centers for disabled and elderly poor people. Many of us have encountered people in desperation due to lack of support, and some among us here have experienced that agony in their own lives. In the past 30 years, wealth in America has become concentrated among the few households at the top. The ranks of the poor have grown, and the middle class, the vast middle class, has felt squeezed. I won't rattle off the many statistics, but here's a telling example from the world of retail sales. Companies that run mid-price chain stores for middle-class customers are hurting financially. It's easy not to notice this, given how many malls we pass in our daily lives. Yet a recent article pointed out that Sears, JCPenney, and Macy's are laying people off and closing stores. These chains focus on the large middle of the market, the shrinking middle class. Yet business is great for the two ends of the market. At the low end, general merchandise retailers like 99 Cents Only and the Dollar Store are popping up all over the country. I can walk to three of them from here. At the other end, chains that cater to high-end consumers are expanding. Business is booming for boutiques and upscale department stores. The sight of conspicuous consumption and the longing to keep up add anxiety to our worries about income and employment stability. Such anxiety makes it hard to appreciate what we do have as individuals, families, and communities. What's normal anymore? What is enough? We may ask ourselves, how do I measure up? How do I measure up? Or the little devil of envy sits on our shoulder. Sometimes envy sits on my shoulder, whispering in my ear, where did you go wrong? Why is life better for so many others than it is for you? Well, I know the saying, money can't buy happiness. I've heard that for ages, but I wonder if that's really true. Some people with a lot of money seem as if they got a good deal on something pretty close to happiness. A cartoon in the New Yorker magazine shows two men with their golf clubs out on the course. One says to the other, researchers say I'm not happier for being richer, but you know how much researchers make? According to English philosopher John Stuart Mill, the issue is not money itself, but the status implied by money. Mill said that people do not just want to be rich, they want to know they are richer than other people. In 1997, as a young adult and a new minister, I moved from the Midwest to California's Silicon Valley, the place of economic boom and bust cycles in these times. In the first year I was there, I attended a Valentine's Day party. The host was a man from a running club that I belonged to, a nice man and well off, owning his own business. He lived in a town on the peninsula south of San Francisco where the venture capital firms are based. He asked me how I liked Silicon Valley so far. How was I adjusting? I told him that I liked my job and my congregation, and I found the South Bay area fascinating. I added, however, that it felt a little strange to know so many people working in high technology firms and to know so many affluent people, my age and younger. I said my insecurities nagged at me sometimes. I'd say to myself, you know, you're not stupid. You even have an MBA. What are you doing in the ministry? He said to me, you know, I found that it doesn't do you any good to compare yourself to others. It's not helpful at all. Of course, he was right. I told him he was right. But what I really wanted to say to him was, well, that's easy for you to say. You drive a Lexus. On the roadways of Silicon Valley, you couldn't miss the contrast of prosperity and the lack of it in the cars around you. The main roads there are strewn with dealerships for luxury, domestic, and foreign cars, like so many diamonds on a bracelet. Cars serve as transportation, but they are also status symbols. Hence, they can spark one's envy. I lived in a condominium complex in San Jose in what had been a modestly priced neighborhood. I'd look out the window at the parking lot in the driveway, at my neighbor's cars, and I wonder if I really belonged there. Maybe my neighbors wondered that too. I, of course, drive a Honda Civic. And after having many parts replaced and the transmission rebuilt, I'm still driving it. The Civic is the ideal car. Low cost, reliable, fuel efficient, and cute in a boring kind of way. I think it's the best internal combustion engine vehicle that one can have at a decent price. Owning it in Silicon Valley enabled me to feel both superior and modest at the same time. Here in Sacramento, I park it on the street. As a result, it gets dirty. When I have an urge for a new car, I take my filthy one to a car wash. After that, it really seems like a new car to me. A makeover for $15 plus tip. Living here in the Central Valley, I perceive a larger diversity of wealth and income. I see that diversity as I eye the cars on the highways and when I circle for a parking space in the parking lots, including our parking lot here at UUSS. It's great for me. Less of a chance for envy. But in these times, everyone is vulnerable to doubts and questions about our relationship with money. If we are not at the top of the economic ladder, how can we avoid the toxic sense of resentment about those who do have lots of money? How do we avoid trading in shame? My Silicon Valley friend said, "It doesn't do you any good to compare yourself to others. It's not helpful." I think that's right. It doesn't help. It doesn't change anything. Most of the people I know who can enjoy nice things have worked hard, saved diligently, or invested wisely. Hard work pays off, and it's nothing to laugh at. It's no more useful to ridicule the fruits of others' labors than it is to judge oneself a miserable failure for not having what other people have. However, it is also true that public policy decisions have shaped the distribution of wealth and income in this country. The word economy that we have comes from a Greek word meaning household. In a representative government, how we construct our common household comes from policy debates and political struggles. An economic system is not a pure product of nature, not handed down from the mind of God. It is built, shaped, and modified by people acting individually and acting as communities, making choices together. For example, the government chooses to favor some industries through subsidies, tax breaks, and trade rules. Various industry lobbyists get the government to make laws and regulations to favor their firms or industries. Another example is how federal tax laws benefit those of us who buy a home with a tax deduction on the interest we pay on our mortgage. To be sure, this deduction has helped many of us in the middle class. But the bigger the price of the house, the bigger the tax deduction. Furthermore, those who can only rent a home do not receive a federal subsidy for their rental expenses. The state of California's budget and finances are now in much better shape than they were a few years ago, but many people are not. A growing number of families with children are still running out of food between paychecks. All of these conditions result in large part from political decisions. Decisions about taxes, public spending, and regulation. We live in the household that our institutions build and maintain. That is my political analysis. Here's my spiritual one. It's true that in the past three decades, the new wealth in this country has gone mostly to those in the top levels. Yet condemning the lifestyles of the rich and famous is a distraction. Just as celebrating them or envying them is a distraction. A distraction from the underlying economic structures in which we live and work. And those distractions will not change the problem. And they won't ease our spirits. To do this will take some personal attention to our own lives. Whoever we may be, we can take some time to reflect on money, on the ways we earn it, spend it, invest it, save it, and the ways we give it away. However well off we may be or not, we can choose to look at our money and our resources through the lens of our spiritual values and our personal ethics. If we can afford some time to be thoughtful about our impulses, anxieties, and aspirations about money and life, we might gain a bit more ease, a bit more clarity about how we use our money. Neither wealth nor poverty is a reason for pride or shame. Some wealth can make life easier. Too much poverty can make life unbearable. But neither one is a reflection of our human goodness. We are born good. Goodness lies in our hearts. The only issue is whether we will choose to put that goodness into action in the world and how we'll do it. In the money-centered culture in which we live, one way to pursue spiritual sanity, spiritual health, is to celebrate the abundance of life, the generosity of nature, and the simple gifts that crowd around us every day. For me, this means a discipline of gratitude. In these times, gratitude can be a useful antidote for anxiety. In these times and in all times. Living in the 1300s, the European philosopher Meister Eckhart wrote these words: "If the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, that is enough." This is the reminder that I need to begin my day before heading out the door or clicking through an inbox full of emails. My mantra of remembering, my daily prayer is this: for the gift of life and the gift of this new day, I give thanks. Then I pause and look around. I call to mind the gifts for which I'm grateful. Mostly they are simple gifts, like the earth beneath my feet, the world around me, and the senses to experience it, food and shelter, my friendships, my work, and this congregation. Over time, this discipline of gratitude has brought me back from envy and anxiety. It has erased and eased much of my anxiety. Giving thanks is my grounding. When I think of the fragility of life, I remember that life is a blessing. When I count my blessings, I step back from counting my possessions. I remember that life is abundant and I am grateful. Meister Eckhart wrote, "If the only prayer you ever say in your entire life is thank you, that is enough." So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.